Well, it's a pleasure today to welcome E.J. Chichilinski.
It's a pleasure to welcome E.J. Chichilinski, who's our speaker. And as you can tell from the initial slide, he's from the Salk Institute of Biological Sciences, and he's an associate professor in the Systems Neuroscience Laboratories. He's been there since 1988, and before that, he did his PhD at Stanford, working with Brian Mondell, and then stayed on to work with Dennis Baylor, a killer combination in my view. Before that, he had done a bachelor's and a master's at Princeton and then at Stanford in mathematics. He's touched the usual bases as young faculty member in getting the Helen Hay Whitney Fellow, Alfred P. Sloan Foundation Research Fellowship, and the McKnight Scholars Award. In addition, for reasons that will become evident during his talk, he was awarded the McKnight Technology Innovation in Neuroscience Award for very good reasons, as you'll see. EJ studies that part of the brain that sticks out of the skull and is frequently referred to as the retina. And it has the tremendous advantage of being readily accessible, and not everyone capitalizes on this. Many people continue to record single cells. Even some of us who study it, the brain inside the cranium still study single cells. But you'll see what can be learned from studying multiple cells at the same time with his, I think, revolutionary 312 electrode recording system for the monkey retina. And by doing this, he's basically been able to show what information is leaving the retina and going to the rest of the brain rather than just what a single cell is doing. And I won't pursue this any further because this is the topic of EJ's talk, which is ensemble coding of visual information in primate retina. EJ, it's a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much, Bob, and thanks for everybody's coming. Can anybody not hear me? Okay. I just want to do a factual correction. I've been at the Salk since 1998, not 1988. To me, that's a huge difference.
To me, it's not.
I didn't say anything. So the purpose of the research in our lab is to understand the visual function of the primate retina. And in particular, we would like to understand how it is that spatiotemporal patterns of electrical activity in the output neurons of the retina, which are known as the retinal ganglion cells, convey visual information down the optic nerve to the brain. Now, one of the major challenges we face in this endeavor is the same challenge that's faced in understanding the function of many other neural systems, which is that typically individual neurons do not signal information independently of one another. Instead, typically, neurons show a striking tendency to fire in concerted patterns and signal information in a concerted or a coordinated way. In particular, in the primate retina, it's been studies in many species have shown that retinal ganglion cells, again, the output neurons of the retina, tend to fire spikes and signal information in a highly coordinated way. An important example of this coordination is so-called synchronized firing. That is, a tendency for cells to fire at nearly exactly the same time at rates much higher than would be predicted by chance alone. Substantial synchronized firing was demonstrated in the cat retina in beautiful paired recordings by Mastronardi in the early 1980s. Now, the presence of substantial synchronized firing or concerted firing in general means that certain aspects of the neural code of the retina are clearly out of reach of traditional single electrode recordings. Indeed, it's been hypothesized that synchronized firing may form, if you will, a unique symbol in the neural code of the retina, and perhaps may be dedicated to conveying specific types of visual information from the retina to the brain. Now, that hypothesis is unproven, but whether it's true or not, there are other reasons to suspect that synchronized firing, that in the absence of understanding synchronized firing and concerted firing in general, we're going to have trouble fully understanding the neural code of the retina. One reason is that if two cells that tend to fire synchronized spikes synapse onto a single postsynaptic target, there's every reason to think that they will be much more likely to drive the postsynaptic target cell to action potential threshold, and therefore that synchronized spikes may be conveyed with particularly high efficacy through downstream circuits. Another reason to suspect that synchronized firing is important is that even in the most extreme case where it carries no visual information, it still alters how we think about the retinal signal. Specifically, even if synchronized firing represents mere common noise or a tendency for cells to fire together spontaneously and nothing more, that the synchrony in a collection of cells means that the noise in the retina has a particular spatial structure, and that spatial structure will influence what kinds of visual stimuli the retina can encode faithfully and what kinds it cannot. So no matter how you look at it, understanding synchronized firing is going to be an important aspect of understanding the neural code of the retina. Almost all studies that have examined synchronized firing in the retina so far have focused on the activity of pairs of cells, looking at two cells at a time. But real retinal signals are conveyed from the retina to the brain by the activity of tens, hundreds, or even thousands of cells. So obviously, understanding concerted firing and synchronized firing in larger populations is of clear importance. In addition, until the work I'll be telling you about today, nothing was known about synchronized firing in the retinas of primates. And I don't have to tell this group that the primate visual system, in particular the macaque monkey visual system, is the most important model for human visual function in use today. Therefore, understanding how synchronized firing works in the macaque monkey is also of obvious importance. So, in my talk today, I'm going to focus on two main questions. First, what is the structure of multineuron concerted firing in the primate retina? And second, how does concerted firing influence the visual signals that are transmitted from retina to brain? Now, to get at these questions, we use a collection of techniques in my laboratory that are unique. And so I'm going to spend the next few minutes going over the techniques in some detail so you understand how we're going to probe these kinds of questions. This slide shows a cross-section through the human retina on the left, and on the right is shown a schematic indication of what's going on over here, which illustrates the conserved architecture of the vertebrate retina, with photoreceptor cells that transduce light into electrical signals, interneurons that perform substantial processing of these signals, and retinal ganglion cells that communicate visual information from the retina to the brain. As I mentioned earlier, all of the work that I'll talk about today is performed in the retinas of macaque monkeys. And the primary reasons are, first, the macaque monkey retina is extremely similar to the human retina and thereby provides an important understanding of human visual function. And second, that because the macaque monkey visual system is so widely studied in so many aspects today, we think it's important to understand what's happening in the macaque retina, which begins visual processing. We obtain macaque monkeys from the laboratories of other investigators who use them in the course of research, of their research. When the animal's to be euthanized, we go, we take the eyes, we bring them back to our laboratory and record from them for periods of 12 to 36 hours. The way that we study the retina is to record the electrical activity from retinal ganglion cells by placing a small segment of retina flat on an array of extracellular microelectrodes embedded in a glass dish. A schematic of the preparation is shown on the left with the retina on top of the electrode array, superfused with an oxygenated saline solution, and stimulated from above with the optically reduced image of a computer display. The advantage of this preparation is that it allows us to present a visual stimulus to the retina that's spatially patterned while at the same time studying the activity of many retinal ganglion cells. Now, all the data I'll be telling you about in the talk today was obtained using a unique 512 electrode recording system that was developed in a collaborative effort led by Alan Litke, professor of physics at University of California, Santa Cruz. Below is shown a schematic of the custom electronics that are used to record the signals from 512 electrodes that are embedded at the very center of this recording chamber. The electrode array is shown blown up schematically here with 60 micron separation between the individual electrodes in a 16 by 32 configuration. Sample action potentials are shown at the upper right. The advantage of the system is that we can record the activity of hundreds of ganglion cells simultaneously, and you'll see why that's important in just a couple of minutes. When we begin our recordings, I'm not going to talk about the multitude of technical issues that involve sorting out the spikes from hundreds of cells simultaneously, other than to tell you it's a lot of work and that you don't want to hear about it in this talk. You'd rather hear about the science. But once we do segregate the action potentials from different cells, what we need to do is to characterize what kinds of cells we're recording from and what their light response properties are. And we do so using the stimulation and analysis paradigm illustrated in this slide. Briefly, we present what's often called a white noise stimulus, where the intensity and color of each of the pixels in the display is drawn randomly and independently of all the other pixels and randomly and independently over time. When we've done about a half hour of recording with this kind of a visual stimulus in place, we characterize all of the cells simultaneously by computing the so-called spike-triggered average stimulus, which tells us where the receptive field of the cell is. What I mean by that is that when we finished with that stimulation run, we go to each of the spikes that's been obtained from a particular cell, and in the period of 250 milliseconds before the spike, we identify what stimulus was played, because we knew what the stimulus was. And then we take the average of that stimulus across all of the spikes in the spike train. This gives us a 250 millisecond movie of the average stimulus sequence that preceded a spike in a given cell. This tells us what the cell tended to respond to during the stimulation sequence. And an example of that movie is shown on the right, and I'm going to play it right now. Here we go. What you can see is that this cell tended to fire a spike after a brightening in a particular region of the display, which we refer to, for obvious reasons, as the receptive field of the cell, the location that caused it to respond. We summarize the receptive field of the cell with a Gaussian fit, whose one standard deviation contour outline is shown here. This way, we can characterize responses of many cells simultaneously, and a summary of the data obtained in one recording is shown in this panel of this slide. These are the receptive fields of about 350 different retinal ganglion cells recorded at the same time. You can see the faint rectangular outline of the electrode array in the background. So there's good news and bad news here. The good news is we're recording from a lot of cells, which allows us to hopefully study the problem of coordinated activity in many cells simultaneously in the retina. The bad news is that this looks like a bit of a mess, and it's not obvious how we're going to figure out what the structure of these signals is. This isn't a place where the 512 electrode recording system comes in very handy. It turns out that the reason that we're seeing this big mess is because there are multiple different retinal ganglion cell types in the retinas of mammals. Roughly 20 distinct cell types in the retinas of macaque monkeys, which project to different targets in the brain. We have to be able to segregate those signals if we're going to understand the structure of multineuron concerted firing. We can do so by examining parameters of the light response of each of the separate cells, as shown in this particular example, where we look at the diameter of the receptive field and the amplitude of the light response. But there are many other parameters we can look at, so don't worry too much about what these parameters are. What I want you to focus on is that if we plot these parameters for all of the cells recorded simultaneously, what we see is that the different cells fall into distinct clusters in this space that are easily segregatable. And when we go and we identify the receptive fields associated with each of these clusters, we obtain a very different picture of their layout in space. I want to make a few points about these data. First of all, what you can see is that once we separate out the functionally distinct cell classes, each cell class, the receptive fields of each cell class, uniformly and apparently completely tile the surface of the retina. That's really important because we know from multiple anatomical studies that the morphologically distinct cell types in mammalian retinas that project to different targets in the brain each tile the surface of the retina with their dendritic fields. So the observation of receptive fields that form this perfect and highly non-random tiling tells us that we can immediately segregate the different cell types simultaneously recorded just by looking at their response properties. A second point I'd like to make is that because they tile this way, we can estimate the density of each cell type and identify the morphological class in many cases. And the class I'm going to focus on today is the on and off parasol cells, because we record from them completely, and you'll see they have nice, interesting properties to study. Finally, I want to point out that in the on and off parasol cells, we routinely obtain nearly complete recordings, a nearly complete mosaic of receptive fields. And what I mean by that is that there are no holes, apparently no holes in here, so we think that we're recording from every on-parasol cell over this 4-by-8-degree patch of the peripheral primate retina. And that becomes very important for studying the collective activity. Okay, so we'll focus on the on and off-parasol cells, and the first question is do we observe synchronized firing in these cell types? And, of course, the answer is yes, otherwise I wouldn't have brought you this far. But I want to bring you to show you an example. If we pick out these two cells in this mosaic of on-parasol cells and we examine their cross-correlation, we can see evidence for synchronized firing. The cross-correlation function tells you the firing rate of one cell as a function of time relative to the occurrence of a spike in the second cell. This sharp peak tells you that when the second cell fired a spike, by definition at time zero, the first cell showed a greatly elevated probability of firing a spike at almost exactly the same time. So clearly there's a tendency for synchronized firing. I emphasize that this recording was obtained in the presence of steady, spatially uniform illumination upon the retina. So there's nothing about the visual stimulus that's causing these cells to fire at the same time. Instead, this synchrony in their firing is produced by the circuitry of the retina, which is what we want to understand. We see a similar pattern for off-parasol cells, although weaker synchronized firing between a neighboring pair of off-parasol cells. This synchronized firing is highly systematic and orderly, as we can identify by plotting an index telling us the strength of this synchrony for many different cell pairs examined in this population. The index is the probability of observing spikes in both cells divided by the probability that would be expected by chance and expressed on a log 2 scale. That index is shown plotted for all the cell pairs in this preparation and this preparation at the bottom here. So the index is shown as a function of the distance between the receptive fields of the pairs of cells. What we can see is that whenever two on-parasol cells are within about 100 micrometers of one another, they are strongly synchronized together. And that degree of synchrony systematically declines up to about 500 micrometers in this particular recording. You can see that it declines to chance values, which is what the index of zero reveals, at long distances. So nearby cells are strongly synchronized with one another. The same thing is true for off-parasol cells, just a different degree of overall synchronized firing. So what we conclude from these data is that synchronized firing is present and strong in the retina of macaque monkeys. It's highly systematic and orderly and spatially localized, and it's cell type specific. Clearly, synchronized firing is an elementary aspect of the retinal signal. Now, so far, these studies primarily confirm the results of Mastronardi in the 1980s, but in this case, in the primate retina, and extending them in some various small ways. But that's primarily what we've done in this slide. But like most studies, so far, all we've talked about is the synchronization of pairs of retinal ganglion cells, two cells examined at a time. But visual signals are conveyed by many cells at a time. And just looking at this picture, you immediately wonder, well, this may be a very small aperture view onto a much larger pattern of concerted activity in the population. Is that true? So to answer that question, I'm going to show you a movie of the activity of a whole collection of on-parasol ganglion cells recorded simultaneously in the presence of spatially uniform background light. In each movie, each frame will tell you the firing pattern that's observed in the population during a 10-millisecond time bin. When the cell is firing, it's colored red. When a cell is not firing, it's colored gray. So as I play this movie, look for the patterns of synchronized firing in the population. So what you can see is that as we extend over time, and the time units are shown down here, we see these clumps of activity that occur on a fairly repetitive basis, telling us that indeed looking at the mere activity of cell pairs really gives us an incomplete picture of what the patterns of concerted activity are in the retina normally. So this brings up the question of, okay, what are the patterns and what do they tell us about how the retinal circuitry is creating them? And of course, you can come up with many hypotheses for the kinds of circuitry that could produce patterns of electrical activity like this, the obvious ones being, on the one hand, the idea that there is common input from presynaptic neurons driving simultaneous activity in collections of on-parasol cells. Alternatively, another natural hypothesis is that there's local connectivity between the cells that causes neighbors to fire when individual cells fire. And in fact, there's evidence of various kinds for both of these sorts of mechanisms in on-parasol cells from the recent recordings of Fred Riecke and in previous studies in other species by other investigators. Now, okay, so these are the kinds of things that could operate, but what I want to emphasize is when you see those structured patterns of activity in the whole population, it raises a huge problem, which is as we begin to consider what are all the possible connectivities and interactions that could underlie these patterns of activity, we have an explosively difficult problem. And I want to explain that with a simple cartoon example. Let's consider if we have a population of just 8 neurons, all the different patterns of input that we can imagine onto those 8 neurons that would maybe create patterns of spontaneous activity. Here's one, here's one, here's one, and so on. Now, the number of such patterns is on the order of 2 to the n, where n is the number of neurons, because any such pattern either does or does not contact a given neuron in this population. For n equals 8, 8 cells, the total number of these kinds of patterns is about 256. That's just enough that it's a bit ugly if I try to put them all in one diagram. as we go to collections of, you know, on the order of 100 neurons, which is what we were just looking at, this number becomes a nightmare. It's an astronomical number, literally. In particular, 2 to the 150th, which is what we saw on the previous slide, is larger than the total number of stars in the observable universe. So I think it's safe to say that if we're going to inspect that movie one frame at a time and try to understand what the patterns are just by looking at it, we're going to be doing this for a really long time. And so I think we're motivated, therefore, to try to ask, are there rules that underlie the structure of those firing patterns that will give us insight and allow us to at least constrain the world of possibilities for what's going on in the retina that produces these patterns of activity? That's what I'm going to spend the next few minutes trying to identify, whether there are such simplifying rules that allow us to understand those patterns of activity. Now, one rule that you might consider is illustrated schematically on the right, namely that perhaps all of the interactions we observe are pairwise. What I mean by that schematically is that, for example, contact onto just two cells at a time, that one and that one in this diagram, and not more. Now, if all the interactions are purely pairwise, it turns out that the total number of them is on the order of about n squared. This is a much smaller number than 2 to the n. For, let's say, order of 100 neurons, 2 to the 100th is this gigantic number. 100 squared is only 10,000. That's a potentially tractable number with the kind of tools that we have today. So if it were true that interactions were all pairwise, that would represent an enormous simplification of the structure of the underlying signals in the retina. Another possible constraint that we might look out for in our data is the possibility that the interactions are all what I call adjacent, that is, that they encompass all of the cells in a region without skipping any. And again, the total number of adjacent patterns is on the order of n squared, so this turns out to be also a dramatic simplification. So here we can actually represent all the adjacent patterns and all the pairwise patterns in one neat little picture. Even more valuable would be if we could find evidence that both of these kinds of structures can be observed simultaneously. That is, perhaps all the interactions are both pairwise and adjacent, and there are only about n of those in the entire signal. So that would be really fantastic if we could simplify the problem to that degree. So what I'm going to do is to tell you how we've looked to see whether these kinds of simplifying rules could apply and help us understand the patterns of activity that we observe in the primate retina. How do we do that? Well, we begin by just simply writing down the problem in the way that we did when we looked at synchronized firing. The spike train of each cell can be considered as a sequence of zeros or ones in these 10 millisecond time bins that I mentioned. One indicates the presence of a spike, zero indicates no spike. Synchronized firing is when both cells fire a spike simultaneously, and in particular when they do so with a probability that's not equal to the product of the individual probabilities, that is higher than different from what we'd expect by chance. Well, this logic is very easily extended to three or more cells. Here are now three cells. Synchronized firing is when all three of them fire at a rate not predicted by chance. But this isn't good enough for understanding the pattern of activity of the entire population. We're not just interested in the case when all 100 cells fire simultaneously. In fact, I don't think we've ever seen that in our data. We're interested in the case when there are these blocks of firing in the overall population that you observed a couple of minutes ago. So we want to look at not just when they all fire together, but when one of them fires and the other two don't, when two of them fire and the other one doesn't, and so on and so forth. And so the way to summarize this problem is that we're trying to identify, we're interested in all of the different firing patterns in the population. With three cells, there are exactly 8 firing patterns. Each cell either is firing or isn't. So we get 2 cubed different possibilities. That is, we can summarize the probability of all these events occurring by what I'll refer to as a firing pattern distribution. On the x-axis is shown the firing pattern, 000, 001, and so on, all up to 111. And on the y-axis is shown probability of observing that pattern in the data set on a logarithmic scale. Okay, so that's a summary of the data, the prevalence of the different kinds of firing patterns that emerge in these three cells. Now, the predictions of statistical independence for a particular set of three cells that we recorded from are shown on the right, this set of three cells are shown on the right-hand side. You can see that this distribution differs greatly from this one here. I remind you that the vertical axis is a log scale, and so, for example, here the 111 firing pattern shows up in the data almost an order of magnitude more frequently than you would expect from the statistically independent prediction. All right, so this is no surprise that statistical independence fails to explain our data. We already knew that from looking at pairs of cells, so surely it would fail to explain the activity in triplets of cells. The reason I've placed this diagram up here is because it serves as a benchmark. If we're going to understand the concerted firing patterns in the whole retina, what we need to be able to do is explain the difference between this and the observed data. That's our benchmark. So remember, what we'd like to do is ask whether there are simple rules that can explain it. And the first rule we'd like to ask about is whether the synchronized firing can be explained purely on the basis of the pairwise interactions. So how do we do that? How do we tackle that? Well, we can write the problem down as follows. What we have is firing patterns in a group of three cells. I'm sticking with the three-cell example because it's simple. And a firing pattern distribution, which is a probability distribution over these patterns. Now, what we'd like to ask is whether we can explain the data on the basis of mere pairwise interactions. So what firing pattern distribution would we expect if there were only pairwise interactions that were governing these patterns of activity? What firing pattern distribution would we expect? Well, we need to know what that expectation is so we can test whether it explains our data. In other words, we need to know what our null hypothesis is. So how do we determine that null hypothesis? Well, we take our data and we start writing things down. It's the usual first step. Let's write some things down. What do we know from our data? Well, we know the firing rates of the individual cells, and we know the probability that pairs of cells fired together. Well, that tells us something about the probability distribution that we'd expect. We'd expect, for example, that these four terms have to add up to the firing rate of the first cell, because each of these has a 1 in its first entry. And these four terms must add up to the firing rate of the second cell, and so on. So there's some constraints on what we'd expect from pairwise interactions alone. And here are the crucial constraints. The probability that cells 1 and 2 fire together must equal the sum of these two probabilities, because they both contain 1-1 as their first two entries. So from our measurements, we have constraints on what the firing pattern distribution is that we would expect from pairwise interactions alone. This is the kind of thing you write down, and then you say, well, is this enough to tell me what my null hypothesis is? What do we expect from just the pairwise interactions? There's a big problem. We have 6 linear constraints, and we have 7 free parameters. Why 7? Well, there are 8 different firing patterns, and a probability distribution has to integrate to 1, so there are 7 unknown parameters. So what this means is that there's an infinite number of possibilities for P of X. In other words, in trying to explore this question, can we explain everything on the basis of pairwise interactions, we've run into a situation where we don't even know what the null hypothesis is. That seems bad. So, okay, but our intuition tells us, well, gee, there ought to be a way to take these observations of individual firing rates and pairwise interactions and ask whether they can explain the entire data set. And there is such a way, and it was developed in beautiful work by Jaynes in the 1950s in statistical mechanics, and has since been applied to a variety of fields, most recently in neuroscience. So, and here's how it goes. We go back to this problem of what firing distribution would we expect just if there are only pairwise interactions. And the answer is the distribution which satisfies those constraints I showed you in the previous slide from our data, but subject to those constraints, it has maximal entropy or maximal randomness. In other words, our null hypothesis should be the collection of firing patterns or the distribution of firing patterns that is consistent with the pairwise interactions we measured and consistent with the firing rates we measured, but other than that has no structure, no propensity to produce particular firing patterns at the expense of others. Now, for the aficionados, and I'll get through this briefly, this can be formalized as a constraint optimization problem where we compute the entropy of the distribution and with Lagrange multipliers place constraints that we obtain from our data and thereby compute the maximum entropy distribution. It turns out that this thing has a unique maximum and so is findable in real data, and these ideas were introduced, I should mention, by these authors in a sequence of very nice papers. So this is some fancy-looking math, but what is it for the rest of us? For the rest of us, it means this. We can take our data, our observed firing rates, and our observed pairwise interactions, and we can put them into this machine and turn the crank, and what comes out of this machine is a meaningful null hypothesis for what the firing pattern distribution is. Recall, we've measured the firing pattern. We want to ask, is it consistent with what we would predict merely from these two factors? So now we go ahead and do that. And the results are shown in the next slide. Here's the firing pattern distribution for a collection of 3 cells. It's what I showed you before. On the right is shown the predictions from statistical independence, and in the center is shown the predictions from this pairwise model. What we can see is that the pairwise model does a very good job of explaining the structure of the observed firing patterns. That is, it takes us all the way from this distribution, which differs greatly from this one, almost all the way to the data. So that's a very satisfactory description of the true firing pattern distribution obtained merely from the pairwise interactions. This logic extends perfectly and easily to multiple cells. For example, here's the firing pattern distribution for 5 cells. You can see it differs tremendously from the independent distribution. Again, remember, these are on a logarithmic scale. Look at the number of zeros as well. And we can see that the pairwise model recovers that difference rather satisfactorily. In fact, if you compute how much of the difference between independence and the observed data are captured purely on the basis of pairwise interactions using a natural measure of likelihood, which I won't dig into in this talk, it turns out we can capture about 99% of this difference merely by supposing the pairwise interactions in groups of 3 to 7 cells. I should also point out that in a parallel study that was completed and was done a little bit before our work, Schneidman and colleagues found that in the salamander retina, they were able to explain about 90% of the interactions of the firing pattern distribution on the basis of pairwise interactions. Superficially, that result seems similar to our finding, but just for the aficionados, if you care to know, I think the differences in those studies are actually enormous to the point where the conclusions are quite different. So I'm not going to go into that now. I'm glad to do so in the question and answer or privately afterward, if you like. In any case, we felt pretty satisfied that we were able to explain about 99% of the structure of the data in our recordings, sufficiently so that we thought we would write a paper about it. However, I think that even seeing this brings up a couple of major limitations to the approach taken so far. Even though we can explain the data rather well, there's a couple of major limitations. A first limitation is that in considering the pairwise interactions that we use to predict the structure of firing in the population, we made no distinction between local interactions and faraway interactions in our data. That doesn't make any sense. We saw early on that the structure of synchronized firing in the retina is highly systematic, highly orderly, and highly localized. So that brings up the very likely supposition that this is perhaps an overfitting exercise or a model that's far too complex given the much simpler nature of the retinal structure that we've seen. And it brings up the idea that what we really ought to be doing is looking at a much more constrained model of activity where perhaps only neighbor interactions or nearby interactions are governing the pattern of activity in the circuit. And we're going to do that. The second problem that it brings up is that for technical reasons, we only examined groups of up to 7 cells before. And there are some important technical reasons for doing so. But you can see that the firing patterns are larger than 7 cells. They extend over these big chunks. And so it's a really critical question to ask is whether this kind of simple model of pairwise interactions can explain what's happening in the whole network. And this gives me, so that turns out to be difficult. Turns out to be difficult to fit this model to data collected from 150 cells. And this gives me the opportunity to advertise the incredible technical skills of Jonathan Schlenz, the graduate student who performed this work, who figured out the advanced Monte Carlo techniques that are required to perform this analysis. And I won't say anything more about that now. Okay, so what we really want to do is to understand whether pairwise adjacent interaction can explain the firing patterns and can do so in the context of the whole circuit. Now, it turns out that even once we generate a prediction, and I'll show you the predictions in a minute, we can't assess the fit of the model using likelihood, as I told you before, that 99% figure. It's not possible to compute that figure with order of 100 neurons. You can't get a decent estimate of likelihood. Instead, we're going to look at several ad hoc statistics about the data to give us a sense of whether we are capturing the nature of the firing patterns. So in particular, we're going to look at how many neurons are firing per frame. So in this frame, there would be 5 plus 6 plus 2 neurons firing. How many neurons are firing in each of the contiguous groups defined by adjacency. So 5 neurons firing, 6, and 2 would all fall into this distribution. And the total number of adjacencies between neurons that are firing. So these are 3 measures, if you will, of the spatial structure of firing that we will examine to test whether we can explain those patterns of activity accurately. Now, the predictions of what these statistics... Oh, and I should say, these are the data, shown in gray, and probability is shown on a linear scale and on a log scale above and below, respectively. Okay, so the predictions from statistical independence are shown in blue. We knew that would fail, but here is showing you how much it fails, and you can measure that by reading off the vertical axis units. Okay, so that's the model that we knew should fail. And then finally, up above is shown the architecture of the pairwise adjacent model. What we're asking is, can we explain all these statistics of firing, all these properties of firing in that pattern of activity, merely on the basis of interactions between adjacent cells in the mosaic? And this shows the interactions that are being used to constrain the model. And finally, the predictions of that model are shown superimposed on the data in red. What you can see is that we achieve a rather satisfactory description of the entire pattern of activity in this case, I believe, something like 60 to 70 cells, simultaneously with this simplest possible model. I mean, I want to emphasize that Once you know that cells don't fire independently, it's hard to imagine a simpler model than one in which cells interact merely with their immediate neighbors and nothing more. And that's exactly what this model is, and yet it has very great explanatory power of our data all the way down to one part in 1,000. So that it seems like we are able to beat down this combinatorial explosion of possibilities with an extremely simple model. It turns out this model has another valuable feature, which is that it, given that it describes the data well, it gives us insight into how important the influences of network interactions are on each cell. Specifically, and here's a brief break for the aficionados, this model can be recast in a parameterization where we separate out terms that have to do with the independent drive to each cell, that is, what it is that causes independent cells to go independently of others, and interactions between cells in the network. And in fact, those interactions are indicated by the thickness of the red lines in this diagram. So what it comes down to is if we measure the strength of the network interactions versus the independent drive to each cell, that we can measure the strength of network and independent drive to each cell. What we see as we look around the edges here, the independent drive to each cell is systematically overestimated. That makes sense because we don't have the neighbors. We haven't recorded the neighbors of that cell. Our electrode array only goes out to here. But if we look at the internal part of this diagram, which is where we have all the data that we need, what we can see is that the network and independent drives to each cell are comparable. They're roughly in balance. What that tells us is that not only are there these interactions, but these interactions are important. The network interactions are roughly as important as the independent drive governing the activity of each cell. Okay, so what have we learned here? We've learned that the large-scale patterns of synchronized firing can be explained very accurately by pairwise adjacent interactions, the simplest possible model for interactions in such a large network. And that goes a long way to explaining all the prevalence of the different patterns of firing that we observe. And what I mentioned briefly at the end there was that, in fact, network interactions are about as strong as the independent drive to each cell. So the network interactions are an important part of what each cell does, but they're incredibly simple and can be summarized in a very simple model. Now, what does this tell us about mechanism underlying synchronized firing? The brief answer I want to give is not much. This is not a statement about the mechanism. And the mechanisms of synchronized firing are still being investigated. What this tells us, I think, is that we can basically put our arms around the problem and say the firing patterns that we observe are only the ones that can be predicted on the basis of neighbor interactions. You can fully understand everything in the circuit if you know what each cell is doing and you know how it's communicating with its neighbors. That explains everything. That means that we don't have to hypothesize arbitrarily complex pattern of electrical activity in the network that may be communicating interesting visual signals. No, it's a very simple set of firing patterns that's explained by this simple network architecture. Now, so I think that's very helpful in limiting the combinatorial explosion that I told you about before, but there are also some very severe limitations to this approach. And surely some of you have been thinking about these, namely, what about the firing dynamics, which I have not explained, and light responses? Firing dynamics, what I mean by that is, recall that what we did was we took the observations of the different firing patterns and we essentially threw them all into a bucket. And we asked, if I reach into this bucket and pull out a firing pattern, how likely am I to get one pattern versus another? But neural responses don't all go in a bucket. They evolve over time. One follows the next, and there's interactions between spike trains over time. We have not accounted for that at all in this structure. Perhaps more importantly, we haven't said anything yet about light responses. All the data I've told you about so far have to do with spontaneous activity in the presence of spatially uniform background light. So we want to understand, what about the firing dynamics and light responses? However, it turns out that this framework that I told you about, although it's wonderful in the sense of having this maximum entropy framework, although it's wonderful in the sense of making almost no assumptions about what's going on in the network and just letting the data tell you, it has the downside of being very data hungry. In order to apply the maximum entropy approach to firing dynamics and light responses, we would need to be able to record from retinas for periods of time much longer than we can actually record. So we need to turn the page. I think we understand what's going on with the spontaneous firing pretty well. We understand the structure of the interactions. But if we're going to go here, we're going to need to use a new technique. And that's what I'm going to tell you about in the last little chunk of the talk. So the technique that we have used is the following. And this technique was developed by our collaborators, the laboratory of Eero Simoncelli, and in particular Jonathan Pillow and Liam Paninsky. The idea is this. We're going to develop a different model, a detailed model of the firing dynamics and light responses in retinal ganglion cells. I haven't said anything about a specific model of light responses of ganglion cells yet, or of firing dynamics, and I'm going to show you now a very specific model for how they work. And in fact, this model, it turns out, will explain the light response data of ganglion cells as well as or better than any previous model for single cells, but has the major advantage of incorporating the synchronized activity, which has never been done. That model, we will then use that model to reconstruct the stimulus from spike trains. In other words, that model will serve as an understanding of how the retina is transducing information, and we'll ask, well, given the spike trains that the retina generated, how well can I identify what the stimulus was that produced those spike trains? And the model will turn out to be the tool for doing that. Okay? So remember, the model, I'll give you some description of the model, but I'm not asking you to take it seriously as a biophysical implementation. All I'm asking you to do is take a look at the data I'll show you in a minute and see that the model reproduces the light responses very accurately and reproduces the synchronized firing very accurately and therefore serves as a very useful tool. And the utilization of the tool will be the last slide. So let me take you briefly through the model, show you that it works, and then show you how we use it. The model that turns out to be an incredibly valuable tool is shown here. It's referred to as a generalized linear model. Much of the model resembles models that have been used to characterize ganglion cells in the past. The model begins with the visual stimulus, which is passed through a spatiotemporal linear filter that results in a generator signal in the cell. Let's think of this generator signal conceptually as perhaps being the current, the synaptic current that impinges on the ganglion cell. And this linear filter is the integration of photoreceptor inputs in the retina over space and over time. That is, it's the spatiotemporal receptive field of the cell that allows the cell to integrate all those inputs from photoreceptors and produce a current. Don't take these biophysical ideas too seriously, but I'm giving you sort of a handle so you can think about what this model might represent. That single univariate signal is then passed through an exponential nonlinearity, producing probabilistic spikings depending on the output. Think of this component of the model as the spike generation process, loosely speaking. And that generates a collection of spikes. Okay? So that's a model for this, that's a model for a single ganglion cell. That's the standard model that lots of people use for various reasons. It's simple, it's okay, but it's not a very good model of ganglion cell response. It's a passable stand-in when you have nothing better. Now, a critical addition to the model that really helps in explaining ganglion cell responses is a post-spike feedback. When the model generates a spike, a particular current is fed back to this stage with a stereotyped waveform. And that current, it turns out, allows the model to capture important dynamics in the light response, structure in spike trains that simpler models could not capture. So this feedback is really an essential element of the model that allows it to work well, as I'll show you in a minute. This model framework extends very naturally to when you're talking about multiple cells simultaneously. Each individual cell behaves the same way. But in addition, there's a feedback term whereby when this cell generates a spike in the model, it feeds back something to the other cell, and conversely as well. Okay, so that's the overall structure of the model. Looks reasonable. It might be an okay model. I'll show you in a minute that it is. I've given you some crude sense of what the elements represent, but the key point I want to point out is that it turns out that this mathematical structure, the exponential nonlinearity and the feedback that arises from spikes and goes back here, give the model a mathematical tractability that other models simply do not have and becomes crucial in the next stage. So it sounds like an element of technical minutia, but it's not. It's actually a linchpin, and it was a result shown by Liam Paninsky that the parameters of this model can be fitted uniquely and robustly for an entire network. Okay, briefly I'm going to tell you how well the model explains the data. The fits to the model of the model to data from a particular cell are shown here. The spatial structure of the center of the receptive field and the surround with opposite sign light response dynamics. Don't worry about the details for those of you who are not familiar with visual system analysis. For those who are, you can see that these are very reasonable characterizations of the cell. The feedback term reduces the probability of a spike from 1 to 0 for a couple milliseconds after the occurrence of a previous spike, and then it rises back up. So it's an implementation of refractoriness, if you will. And finally, cross-coupling terms cause cells that are nearby the reference cell to have their firing rates greatly elevated after a spike in the reference cell. Okay, so these are the pieces that you get when you fit the model to the data, and the key question is, because this is just a tool, this model is just going to be used as a tool, nothing more. The question is, can we capture the structure in the data? And the answer is yes. So below are shown responses here of a particular on-parasol ganglion cell to repeated presentations of a stochastic stimulus. So it's a noisy stimulus, kind of like the one I showed you before, but it's presented over and over again, the exact same stimulus. This raster shows action potentials recorded from a particular cell. Each tick is an action potential, and each row is a single presentation of the visual stimulus. The banded structure in this raster gives you an idea of the reproducibility of the light response to repeated presentations of the same stimulus. What you can see is that the model reproduces the structure of this raster with rather high fidelity. It tells you the average light response, that is, the periods of times when the cell is firing, as well as the trial-to-trial variability of the light response. It captures both with high accuracy, as high as any other model that I know of to date. So that's nice. We can describe what individual cells are doing. How about the synchronized firing between pairs of cells? Can we also describe that? Yes. If we look at the cross-correlation that the model produces and the data, that both the cross-correlation in the data and the cross-correlation produced by the model for collection, in this case, of 7 on-parasol cells, a reference cell, and its cross-correlation to each of its 6 neighbors, we get these results. Recall that the cross-correlation indicates the firing rate in one cell as a function of time relative to the occurrence of a spike in the second cell. And as we saw before, there's a sharp peak around 0 indicating synchronized firing. This is all in the presence of a visual stimulus, I should say. Now, the data in the model are overlaid in this diagram, and you see we get a satisfactory description of the cross-correlation in the activity. So not only have we been able to explain the light response dynamics of individual cells, but with this model we can capture the correlations in the activity of many cells, which has never been done before. Now, is it important that the model for these cells has these coupling terms, has these interactions between cells? Is that something that really has to be there in order to explain the data? Yes, it does. And we see that by snipping out those coupling terms, setting them to 0, fitting the model again to the data with each cell independent of every other cell. We still get some cross-correlation because of overlap in the receptive fields and the presence of a visual stimulus, but we simply cannot explain these sharp peaks, which have to do with interactions in the retinal network. Okay? So we've got a model that explains the data with high accuracy. If we look across the entire on- and off-parasol cell population in a particular recording, and we plot the cross-correlation functions between all pairs of cells of like type, both the data and the model are shown here. You can see that they overlay. If we clip out the cross-connections, we can see that we fail to explain the synchronized firing. So again, we've got a model that explains the individual cells as well as all the cross-correlation. Okay, try to get that out as quickly as possible. It's a tool. This model is not a description of the biophysics for various reasons that we could talk about. It's a tool. And the point is that the tool captures what's going on in the retinal activity with high fidelity. What good is that? Okay. Well, it's good in the general sense. It's always nice to have a model of what's going on in the circuit. So if we have a stimulus with this model, we can accurately capture the spiking responses produced by an entire network of retinal ganglion cells. That's fine. That's a nice, very nice thing to have, and again, that hasn't existed before. However, what I think is the most important for the questions that we're asking today is the issue of what is the significance of the synchronized firing that we've been talking about on visual signals. And I'm going to ask that question. There are many ways you could measure the significance. You could measure how frequently synchronized spikes occur and so on and so forth. But really, the ultimate visual significance, we think, is probably an ecological one. That is, how does synchronized firing influence the capacity of the animal to use visual signals? The way we're going to attack that in this last slide is to take the approach that was really pioneered by Bialik and colleagues, which is to point out that the animal never cares about a model for light response of its ganglion cells. The animal has to solve the reverse problem. The animal is receiving a collection of spike trains coursing down the optic nerve and has to use that collection of spike trains to make an inference about what's out there in the visual world in order to behave appropriately and adaptively in response to visual stimuli. So we can mimic that by solving what's often known as the decoding problem. That is, what we'd like to do is to take the actual ganglion cell responses, not the output of the model in this case, but the actual ganglion cell responses, and try to infer what the visual stimulus was. Now, we're the experimenters, so we actually know what the visual stimulus was, but what we'd like to ask is, well, if I just perform a smart calculation on the spike trains, how close can I get to that true visual stimulus? And in particular, how important is it that I take into account the synchronized firing in the network? So the way that we do that is to perform this decoding. And again, the mathematical structure of the model turns out to be crucial in order to be able to actually do this. You really can't do this if you build an ad hoc model that doesn't have this nice mathematical structure. But with this structure, you can. And what we can do is perform the decoding using three different approaches and compare them to one another. The three approaches are as follows. The first is the full model approach. We take this model of the ganglion cell responses, and remember now, the model is just being used as a tool. We're going to use the model and invert it, if you will, to take real spike trains and attempt to predict deduce what the stimulus was on the basis of real spike trains. Okay? So what we're feeding the model now is real spike trains. We're giving it real data recorded from the macaque monkey retina in response to a visual stimulus. We apply this approach, the inverted model, to infer what the stimulus was from those spike trains, and then we measure how accurate was that inference. For the full model, the accuracy of the inference is measured by the mutual information between the actual and the decoded stimulus. This is measured in bits per second. I'm just not going to go into that detail. That's a natural way to measure how accurate the model was, but we can talk about that if you want to later. Okay? We're going to compare this, the accuracy of decoding using this model to other approaches. The standard benchmark approach is optimal linear estimation. Linear estimation is perhaps the simplest way you can imagine taking a collection of spike trains and trying to get an estimate of what the stimulus was that preceded them. And that's shown in the black bar. We can see that the full model does significantly better at estimating the stimulus than the standard linear approach. Intermediate between these is the uncoupled model, the case where we've taken the model to do the decoding, but we've snipped the connections in the model. That is, we are not taking into account the correlations. So what we get in these three comparisons is two comparisons. In one case, as we went from the optimal linear estimator to the uncoupled model, we started to take into account spike train structure that is not accounted for in standard linear estimates. But more importantly, for what I'm telling you today, as we went from the full model to the uncoupled model, we learn what the importance is of taking into account concerted firing in the population. And in particular, if we measure this, what we see is that if you're doing the job of estimating the stimulus, you obtain about a 20% improvement in your decoding if you do take into account the synchronized firing. So if you want to walk out of here and ask in your mind, okay, so how important is that synchronized firing for understanding the retinal signal, you can take home a message, at least for the stimulus ensemble that we used, the answer is on the order of 20%. If you were to try to use real retinal spike trains to figure out what the stimulus was, and you did so in a manner that ignored the correlations in the synchronized firing in the network, you would lose out about 20% of the visual signal. And that's the grand summary, if you will, of how much it matters for visual function. I think that in the future, the next important stage is, given that there's a 20% miss, which is quite a lot if we think about the structure of the retina, this 20% miss, the interesting direction for the future is to understand what particular stimuli and what particular patterns of electrical activity are the ones that cause us to miss out on this 20%. And now that we have all these elements in place, I think that now becomes possible because we have an approach to see what you lose if you don't take into account the synchronized firing that's there in the retinal circuitry. Okay, let me conclude by telling you what I've told you, so hopefully you can walk out with the conclusions. I told you that synchronized activity is strong, cell type specific, universal, and spatially localized in the primate retina. So clearly, synchronized firing is a basic part of the neural code in the primate. We found, using the maximentropy approach, that synchronized firing is explained rather accurately by the simplest possible model you can imagine, which is pairwise and adjacent interactions in the network. So we don't need complicated interactions to explain patterns of activity in the network. All you really need to know is what each cell is doing and how it talks to its neighbors. And once you know that, you know what's going on in the whole network. Very simple. We found that there's a model that can capture the dynamics of the concerted activity as well as the visual response very accurately, which gives us some hope that a full description of the network function, including all the correlations in the activity, is potentially within reach, at least for some stimulus conditions. And finally, we found that if you examine what happens in reconstructing the visual stimulus, if you ignore the influence of synchronized or concerted activity, you lose about 20% of the information that's available in your retinal spike trains about the visual signal. So that means that really accounting for the concerted activity that's really present in the retina certainly can improve visual function. Lastly, I want to thank the people who did the work and collaborated with me in doing the work. Particularly, I want to thank John Schlenz, an incredible graduate student in the lab who did all the work on the maximum entropy stuff at the beginning of the talk. He's now a postdoctoral fellow at Berkeley and continues to work with us. I want to acknowledge Jonathan Pillow, who's a graduate student, was a graduate student with Eero Simoncelli and is now at the Gatsby as a postdoctoral fellow. He did all the modeling work that I talked about at the end in collaboration with Liam Paninsky and Eero Simoncelli. Our collaborators, the physicists from University of California, Santa Cruz, the group led by Alan Litke, developed the technology and really made all these recordings possible. All of the people in my lab work collaboratively in our macaque monkey experiments, so that I really want to acknowledge all of them because we work very much as a team. And finally, I want to thank the support of funding agencies as well as those individuals who made it possible for us to obtain monkey retinas without which we couldn't have done the work. Thank you for your time. You want to know what the efficiency is of the decoding. I'm sorry I don't have that number at hand, but even before throwing it out, actually I want to just point out that that is highly dependent on the stimulus ensemble that you choose. For example, we have a 120 hertz refresh monitor, which is much faster than the cells can follow. So if we knock that down to 60 hertz, the visual stimulus has changed, and we'll capture a lot more of the fractional visual signal. So there's a big issue there about if I reported such a number to you, it would be so dependent on the stimulus ensemble that I would worry that it might be overinterpreted, in addition to the fact that I don't have the number handy. So.
Well, let me rephrase the question then. Is that accounting for a lot of the nature of the stimulus, or is it just a small amount? I mean, you got a 20% increase with synchrony.
We think not, because we've obtained such an accurate description of the forward transformation that there's good reason to think that we've got as accurate a description of the reverse as we could hope for. What you're really getting at is what is the information transmission capacity of the retina for a variety of stimuli. I think that the model now allows us to calculate that in a meaningful way. But I'm very sorry, I don't have the answer. If I played it, by the way, if I just showed you the movie, even if I don't have it, but even if I did, it would be hard to make head or tails out of it, because the stimulus that we use is one of these white noise ensembles. So you'd be looking at two white noise ensembles flowing by you and trying to compare them, and it's non-trivial. So really, I mean, it's an interesting question, which is how well does the retina capture the visual scene that's out there? And we now have a tool that can summarize that very nicely, but I haven't made the pictures for you, and I think we would have to do so in the context of particular visual stimuli for you to be able to interpret it.
Related to the 20% increase that you get when you consider current synchronization, my impression is that this will depend on the stimulus ensemble that you're presenting. Like, if you have a random white noise and you want to report a spot, a small coherent movement of dots in a certain visual field angle.
Yes, I'll repeat the question, which is that this number, the 20% improvement number that I cited, has the potential to also depend on the choice of the visual stimulus. That's absolutely right. So that's basically the next step is we're beginning to incorporate natural scene structure and ask what's the percentage improvement when you have more naturalistic structure in the scene. That's an experimental program that has begun, and I don't have the answer right now. But we want to know that. But also, and this is really important, these 20% numbers are useful. It's okay, 20%. But if it's 20% of seeing the tiger behind the bush, that's worth a lot. If it's 20% of seeing the 150th blade of grass over and above the 149th, So you want to get to the point where you're assigning some value to this extra 20%. And I haven't done that at all. So that's why asking whether we can, what is the particular spike train structure and the particular kinds of stimuli that we distinguish better becomes of critical importance. We're just not there. But I think we're now in a position to go there, which for me is very exciting, because prior to this, there was just really no way to get to that point. And so this is an advertisement for the future, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have the parameter count easily at hand. These functions are fitted with on the order of 5 basis functions for each of these, so a particular logarithmically expanding basis set. This is an exponential. There actually aren't that many parameters. There's order of 10 or 15 parameters that describe the entire light response property of the cell. And that, in principle, can predict the light response of the cell to any visual stimulus. That's actually a pretty small parameter set. And we do cross-validate and all the kind of usual stuff to make sure that we're not overfitting. So you also the other way you can tell that there's that the parameter fits are reasonable and not just some ridiculous overfitting exercise is how closely they resemble what you expect from other kinds of measurements, such as the structure of the receptive fields, the surround a little bit bigger than the center, the biphasic dynamics that we often observe, the nature of the refractoriness, and the stereotyped waveforms of the coupling terms that last a certain amount of time. So there's good reason to think that we're on top of the issues of overfitting. I don't think that's a big issue here. The question is, can we measure the information that the spikes capture about the stimulus independent of the model? In principle, yes, there is such a way. The problem is that measuring information is very tricky if you make no assumptions. If you make no assumptions and you have a high-dimensional stimulus and a high-dimensional response, which we have.
I mean, you do something like reliability of producing the thing
spike between. Right. In principle, you can absolutely do it. In practice, the amount of data that you need to just grind that out and do it is prohibitive, absolutely prohibitive. It's not easy to even get that right for a single cell. So if you have a population of 20, 50, whatever cells, forget about it. It's the techniques that are available for doing that are weak, are insufficient with current recordings. You'd have to have recordings that last for weeks or months. Now, the typical way that you solve this is to come in with some assumptions to kind of constrain the complexity of the problem. And the way that we've done it is exactly one such way, which is to assume a particular collection of models and then to be able to compute neutral information that way. So there are assumption-free ways to compute the information, but they won't work for these large populations. They just won't work.
If you look at the US stimulus, you get always a unique response for the given. You know, what I'm asking is you might be giving a repeated random stimuli and getting a repeated random spike pattern. So is it always one-to-one?
No, certainly not. It's never one-to-one. What I mean is there's variability in every neural response. The cell never produces exactly the same response. You can see the variability here. We're seeing the same stimulus presented over and over, and the response variability is given by the fact that the first spike train is a little bit different from the second, a little bit different from the third. And the amount of that variability, indeed, could be captured by a mutual information calculation, but again, you can't do that for the whole network. It's prohibitive.
So your pairwise correlation. In your model, correlations between neurons that are not adjacent are only transmitted between two pairwise or more.
Yes.
So I just wondered how well do you capture those non-adjacent correlations with a model that only has adjacent ones?
And the answer to that is in the statistics in the first half. Exactly right. So there are correlations between cells that are not immediately adjacent. And those correlations are very well captured. I'm sorry, I don't have this. I'll fish around through my slides after, but I think I'd be wasting everybody's time if I did it right now. Very well. And that's why we're able to capture the spatial scale. So, for example, one of the things we measured was the size of the clumps, right? If we were failing to capture, let's say, the second ring of correlation as opposed to the first ring, the clumps would be systematically too small. And you can see we can get the clumps down to about 2 orders of magnitude. So the answer is yes. In fact, that's probably... You know, in some sense, that's the strongest statistic to test about whether we're succeeding in capturing what's going on in the network. The other strong statistic is that if you go further away, there's no correlation, obviously. But that is exactly the kind of over and above what's immediately happening that we do capture.
Okay, last question.
Are we talking about here? I'm sorry, where are we? So we were looking at the generalized linear model. Oh, this waveform. Okay, this is just a schematic. But so the question is, are all the interactions between cells in the model excitatory, or are there some inhibitory ones? Good question. In fact, within each cell population, they are uniformly excitatory, very stereotyped as the data themselves, where you saw that really beautiful fall off of the data, okay? So cells are positively correlated to one another within cell type. Across cell types, there is an anti-correlation, most of which, can be explained by mere receptive field overlap. So an on-cell and an off-cell are anti-correlated, and the degree of that anti-correlation can mostly be explained by the fact that they have overlapping receptive fields and a common stimulus. Not entirely. So there's an indication that there may be something more going on, mutual inhibition, if you will, between on and off cells. I don't think we have a strong handle on that in these data, but that's what it looks like.
But the data shows here, but the results are only for one population.
Actually, I hid that from you. The data are shown actually for the entire on-parasol population, the entire off-parasol population. I've shown you the correlations between on-parasol, which are uniformly excitatory, between off-parasols, which are uniformly excitatory. I have not shown you the cross-correlations, but I have them in another slide, and I'll be glad to show them to you afterward. And those are uniformly inhibitory. And the modeling approach captures everything, all the cells of this type, all the cells of that type, all the correlations within type, and all the correlations between types.
Thank you very much.